hope that it's okay. Or maybe this is how it sounds on air, and that's fine too. It'll just be like I'm in a spaceship or something, or maybe it's like I'm communicating from another dimension, and this is what it sounds like in the other dimension, or as my voice translates from the other dimension into this current reality that we're in. So for today's show, I don't really have anything prepared, so I was thinking about just reading this book, because I have to read it, or I don't have to, I should say, as they say in SOAR, the ropes course company that I work for sometimes, I get to read. So I get to read this book for a book club that I'm part of. It's an API or AAPI reading book club, Asian Pacific Islander or Asian American Pacific Islander book club. And the book that we're reading next Sunday is Native Speaker by Cheng Ray Lee. And as some of you, people who know me, I don't read. I'm really bad at reading. Hold on a second. I've got to make sure that the sound's okay. Maybe I can turn it up a little bit. Okay. So, I have a trouble reading. It's most likely a belief entity that I developed when I was smoking weed. And so it's difficult for me to read. And so I thought maybe I'd take advantage of this show and also embrace my Korean Americanness, and also kind of like what it seems like there's lots of like these AAPI or AAPI coalitions and groups that are emerging. And so embracing that. And also I'm doing a show at the Korean Cultural Center, which is part of this KAFA award that I got, which is KAFA stands for Korean Artists Foundation of America. So part of the award is that I have to have a show. And the show is going to be in November this year. And I'm thinking about doing work about family, specifically my family, which is a Korean family and Korean American family, and about like trauma and stuff like that. And family structures within this culture and Korean culture and stuff like that. So I thought, this book I'm approaching as research, because it's about this. Let me see, what is it about? It is about, as far as I know, I think it's like it's a fiction. Let's see. Okay, here, I'll read the back. Korean American Henry Park is surreptitious, B+ student of life, illegal alien, emotional alien, yellow peril, Neo American stranger, follower, traitor, spy. Or so says his wife, in the list she writes upon leaving him. Henry is forever uncertain of his place, a perpetual outsider looking at American culture from a distance. And now, a man of two worlds, he is beginning to fear that he has betrayed both and belongs to neither. So that's the story of this book. So I'm going to just read it for this hour. So here goes. Okay. Native Speaker by Cheng Ray Lee. I gotta practice my reading and reading aloud. This is good. Okay. The day my wife left, she gave me a list of who I was. I didn't know what she was handing me. She had been compiling it without my knowledge for the last year or so we were together. Eventually, I would understand that she didn't mean the list as exhaustive, something complete. In any way, the sum of my character or nature. Lelia was the last person who would attempt anything even vaguely encyclopedic. But then, maybe she herself didn't know what she was doing. She was drawing up idioms in the list, visions of me in the whitest raw light, instant snapshots of the difficult truths native to our time together. The year before she left, she often took trips, mostly weekends somewhere. I stayed home. I never voiced any displeasure at this. I made sure to know where she was going, who'd likely be there, the particular milieu, whether dancing or a sauna might be involved, those kinds of angles. The destinations were harmless, really, like the farming cooperative upstate, where her college roommate made soft cheeses for the city street markets. Or she went to New Hampshire to see her mother, who'd been more or less depressed and homebound for the last 3 years. Once or twice, she went to Montreal, which worried me a little, because whenever she called to say she was fine, I would hear the sound of French in the background, all breezy and guttural. She would fly westward on longer trips to El Paso and the like, where we first met 10 years ago. Then at last, and every day, from our Manhattan apartment, she would take day trips to any part of New York City, which she loved and thought she would never leave. One day, Lelia came home. I think that's how you pronounce her name. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it. Lelia? Maybe Lelia. One day, Lelia came home from work and said she was burning out. She said she desperately needed time off. She worked as a speech therapist for children, mostly freelancing in the public schools, and then part-time at a speech and hearing clinic downtown. Sometimes she would have kids over at our place. The children she saw had all kinds of articulation problems, some because of psychological defects like cleft palates or tied tongues. Others had laryngectomies, or else defective hearing or learning disabilities, or for an unknown reason had begun speaking much later than was normal. And then others, the ones I always paid close attention to, came to her because they had entered the first grade speaking a home language other than English. They were non-native speakers. All day she helped these children manipulate their tongues and their lips and their exhaling breath, guiding them through the difficult language. So I told her fine, she could take it easy with work, that I could handle the finances. We were solid that way. This is when she professed a desire to travel. She hadn't yet said alone, and then in the next breath admitted she told the school people not to call her for a while. She said she felt like maybe writing again, getting back to her essays and poems. She had published a few pieces in small, serious literary magazines early in our marriage, written some book reviews, articles, but nothing, she said harshly, that wasn't half embarrassing. She handed the list to me at the Alitalia counter at Kennedy before her flight to Rome, and then on to Naples, and finally Sicily and Corsica. This was the way she had worked it out. Her intention was to spend November and December shuttling between the Italian islands in some off-season rental, completely alone. She was traveling heavy. This wasn't a trip of escape in that normal sense. She was taking with her what seemed to be hundreds of books and notepapers, also pads, brushes, tiny pastel-tinted sponges, too many hats, I thought, which she wore like some dead and famed flyer, a signal white scarf of silk, a signal white scarf of silk, nothing I had given her, and maps. Here was a woman of maps. She had dozens of them in various scales, topographic, touristical, some schematic, these last handmade. Through the nights, she stood like a field general over the kitchen counter, hands perched on those jutting hip bones, smoking with agitation, assessing points of entry and encampment and escape. Her routes, stenciled in thick, deep blue, embarked inward, toward an uncharted grave center, a messy bruise of ink. She had already marked out a score of crosses that seemed to say, "You are here." Then there was the indications she was misreading the actual size of the islands. Her lines would have her trek the same patterns of rocky earth many times over, overrunning the land. I thought I could see her kicking at the bleaches, known stones, the hard southern light surrendering to her boyish straightness, those clear green eyes leveling on the rim of the arch sea. Inside the international terminal, I couldn't help her. She took to bearing the heaviest of her bags, but at some point I panicked and embraced her clumsily. Maybe I'll come with you this time, I said. She tried to smile. You're just trading islands, I said, unhelpful as usual. I asked if she had enough money. She said her savings would take care of her. I thought they were our savings, but the notion didn't seem to matter at the moment. Her answer was also, of course, a means of renunciation, itself a denial of everything else I was offering. Let me read that sentence again. Her answer was also, of course, a means of renunciation, itself a denial of everything else I was offering. When they started the call for boarding, she gave me the list, squeezing it tight between our hands. This doesn't mean what you'll think, she said, getting up. That's okay. You don't even know what it is. It doesn't matter. She bit her lip. In a steely voice, she told me to read it when I got back to the car. I put it away. I walked with her to the entrance. Her cheek stiffened when I leaned to kiss her. She walked backward for several steps, her movement inertial, tipsy, and then disappeared down the telescoping tunnel. I read through the list twice sitting in our car in the terminal garage. Later I would make 3 photocopies, one to reside permanently next to my body in my wallet as a kind of personal asterisk, I thought, in case of accidental death. Another I saved to show her again sometime, if I wanted pity or else needed some easy ammunition. The last, to historicize, I sealed in an envelope and mailed it to myself. The original I destroyed. I prefer versions of things, copies that aren't so precious. I remember its hand, definitely Lelia's. Considerable, vertical, architectural, but gone awry in parts, scrawling and windbelt in unschemed colors of ink and graphite and Crayola. I could tell the page had been crumpled up and flattened out, folded and unfolded. It looked weathered, beaten about her purse and pockets. There were smudges of olive oil, maybe chocolate. I imagined her scribbling something down in the middle of a recipe. My first impression was that it was a love poem, an amnesty, dulcet verse, but I was wrong. It said variously, yes, you, wait, I'm sorry, it said variously, you are surreptitious, B+ student of life, first thing hummer of Wagner and Strauss, illegal alien, emotional alien, genre bug, yellow peril, : neo-American, great in bed, overrated, papa's boy, sentimentalist, anti-romantic, blank analyst, parentheses, you fill in, end parentheses, stranger, follower, traitor, spy. For a long time, I was able to resist the idea of considering the list as a cheap parting shot, a last-ditch lob between our spoiling trenches. I took it instead as one long message, broken into parts, terse communiques from her moments of despair. For this reason, I never considered the thing mean. In fact, I even appreciated its count, the clean cadence. And just as I was nearly ready to forget the whole idea of it, maybe even forgive it completely, like the Christ that my mother and father always wished I would know, I found a scrap of paper beneath our bed while I was cleaning. Her signature again. False speaker of language. Before she left, I had started a new assignment. Nothing itself terribly significant, but I will say now it was the sort of thing that you can clinch a person's career. It's the one you spend all your energy on. It bears the fullness of your thoughts until done. The kind of job that you mess up, you've got only one more chance to redeem. If you mess up. I thought I was keeping my work secret from her, an effort that was getting easier all the time, or so it seemed. We were hardly talking then, sitting down to our evening meal like boarders in a room house, reciting the usual drawn-out exchanges of familiar news, bits of the day. When she asked after my last assignment, I answered that it was sensitive and evolving, but going well. And after a pause, Lelia said down to her cold plate, "Oh, good. It's the Henry speak." By then, she had long known what I was. For the first few years, she thought I worked for companies with security problems, stolen industrial secrets, patents, worker theft. I let her think that I and my colleagues went to a company and covertly observed a warehouse or laboratory or retail floor, then exposed all the cheats and criminals. But I wasn't to be found anywhere near corporate or industrial sites, then or ever. Rather, my work was entirely personal. I was always assigned to an individual, someone I didn't know or care the first stitch for on a given day, but who, in a matter of weeks, could be as bound up with me as a brother or sister or wife. I lied to Lelia. For as long as I could I lied. I will speak the evidence now. My father, a Confucian of high order, would commend me for finally honoring that which is wholly evident. For him, all of life was a rigid matter of family. I know all about that fine and terrible ordering, how it variously casts you as the golden child, the slave son or daughter, the venerable father, the long-dead god. But I know, too, the basic comfort in this familial precision, where the relation abides no argument, no questions or quarrels. The truth, finally, is who can tell it. And yet you may know me. I am an amiable man. I can be most personable, if not charming. And whatever I possess in this life is more or less the result of a talent I have for making you feel good about yourself when you are with me. In this sense, I'm not a seducer. I am hardly seen. I won't speak untruths to you. I won't pass easy compliments or odious offerings of flattery. I make do with one-hand materials, what I can chip out of you, your natural ore. Then I fuel the fire of your most secret vanity. Next chapter. Let's see what time it is. Okay. I should have warned my American wife. I met Lelia at a party given by an acquaintance of mine from a college, a minor painter of landscapes. I bumped into him by pure chance in a trinket shop in El Paso. I was in the city on assignment, only my second one solo, and I just completed the job. It had been successful, but I was still jittery, the way you feel after a massive release of energy, my nerves on end and still working. I was planning to fly out that evening, but he invited me to a gathering of some of his artists and crafter friends, and I decided to stay until the next morning. That evening, I went to his living loft and studio, which was on the second floor of a run-down hacienda in an old section of town. The party was crowded, mostly candlelit, the talk unfiltered, unwinding all over the single large room. People were sitting in groups on oversized floor pillows and on cane chairs turned backward, smoking grass and drinking tall neck beers. Nils, the painter, greeted me in the open kitchen. "My good friend Henry," he said stridently, the strangeness of that notion hanging there for us. I simply took his hand. He had a woman with him, or next to him, and he introduced us. She said hello to me, and her voice surprised me with its pitch clear and higher than I was hearing. Its pitch clearer and higher than I was hearing those days. The women I knew back in New York grumbled from down low in the gut, in messy plaints, everything spoken in 2 a.m. areas. It ended up that Lelia was the only person I spoke with. In fact, Nils seemed to want us to talk, if only to keep her occupied while he entertained the other guests. He was probably figuring I wouldn't get in the way. He didn't say as much. They weren't lovers, but I could tell he desired her. The way he was ushering her around with his paint-splattered hand clinging to the small of her neck. Make a gesture, he must have thought. Let my Asian friend in the suit have a pleasant moment with her. She was wearing a sand-hued wrap, a kind of sari, except it was looser than that, as if it had just been unwound and then only casually repinned. One shoulder was bare. I noticed she was very white, the skin of her shoulder almost blue, opalescent, unbelievably pale considering where she lived. When he left us, she bid him goodbye using his surname, with neither irony or derision. Then she told me to wait, and she left. She came back after a few minutes with two beers pressed against her chest and a bowl of tortilla chips in her free hand. I took the bottles from her. They left winged damp marks on her wrap, which she didn't seem to notice. She led us to an open double window at the quieter end of the studio. She balanced the bowl on the wide sill and said to me, I saw you right away when you came in. Did I look that uncomfortable? Terribly, she said. You kept pulling at your tie and then tightening it back up. I saw a little kid in a hot church. I'm usually better at parties, I told her. I'm usually worse, she said. I guess tonight I feel social. We clinked bottles. She was looking at me closely, maybe wondering what a last name like Park meant ethnically. After a while, our talk came round to it, so I told her. I knew, she said, or I was pretty sure. A friend in middle school taught me about Korean names, how Park and Kim were always Korean. The other names like Chung and Cho and Lee may be Korean, maybe Chinese, never Japanese. Am I getting this right? You're getting this right. Aren't you going to guess what flavor my name is? She was about to remind me of it, but I said Boswell aloud, very slowly as if in a recital or B. I guess somewhere in the Commonwealth. I'm too easy, she cried. You even got the Massachusetts part without trying. It's so depressing. You don't know what it's like. An average white girl has no mystery anymore, if she ever did. Literally nothing to her name. There's always a mystery, I offered. You just have to know where to look. I bet, she said. I was immediately drawn to her. I liked the way she moved. I know how men will say this to describe that womanly affect they find ineffable. I'm as guilty as them all. There is a hurt that pinches your throat or chest when you look. But even before I took measure of her face and her manner, the shape of her body, her indefinite scent, all of which occurred so instantly anyway, I noticed how closely I was listening to her. What I found was this, that she could really speak. At first I took her as being exceedingly proper, but I soon realized that she was simply executing the language. She went by word. Every letter had a border. I watched her wide, full mouth sweep through her sentences like a figure touring a dark house, flipping on spots and banks of perfectly drawn light. The sensuality in certain rigors. So I work for a relief agency, she said, warming up. I drive a pickup truck. I deliver boxes of canned food and old clothes to some neighborhoods around town. Many of the people there are illegals, Mexicans and Asians. Whole secret neighborhoods, brown and yellow. Tell me, am I being offensive? I don't think so. Okay, anyway, they know my blue truck. They forget my face, but they know my truck. I carry a box into a house. I check if the infants and children look healthy. The sick ones go on a list for the health service. I come back outside and people are always waiting there. They just want to talk. They know me as the English lady. All day I give lessons from the back of the truck. I sit there and they talk to me. I help them say what they want. How much is this air conditioner? Does this bus go to Sunland Park Racetrack? Yes, I cook and clean, and I can sew. Now I teach a class at night. The same people and more. I try to turn them away, you know, because of fire codes. They look at me confused and don't move. Half of them end up standing. They bring their babies because they heard you can learn in your sleep. What can I do? I let them all stay. Everybody in this town wants to learn English. I offered her what I could of me, inventing a story around the basic reasons why I was in El Paso. She didn't push. Nils finally came around, but Lelia didn't say much, and he said he had to step out for more crushed ice. We didn't see him again. For the next hour or so, we took turns getting each other beers until she came back the last time with a plastic cup full of tequila. It's still too hot in here, she said. Let's go outside. There's a little park a few blocks away. We sat on a bench among the sleepers. It was a clear night, the moon, a few high clouds. I'd given her my suit jacket. Some others were awake, talking and drinking like us. I heard them speaking Spanish, and I heard English, and then something else that Lelia said was called mix-up. Its music was sonorous, rambling, some of the turns unexpected and lovely. Everywhere you heard versions. People like me are always thinking about still having an accent, I said, trying to remember the operation of the salt, the liquor, the line. Lime. I can tell, she said. I asked her how. You speak perfectly, of course. I mean, if we were talking on the phone, I wouldn't think twice. You mean it's my face? No, it's not that, she answered. She reached over as if to touch my cheek, but rested her arm instead on the bench back, grazing my neck. Your face is part of the equation, but not in the way you're thinking. You look like someone listening to himself. You pay attention to what you're doing. If I had to guess, you're not a native speaker. Say something. What should I say? Say my name. Lelia, I said. Lelia. See? You say, Lelia. So, deliberately, okay, now I know how to pronounce her name, Lelia, so deliberately. You try not to, but you were taking in the sound of the syllables. You're very careful. So are you. She took a sip from the cup. It's my job, Mr. Henry Park. Unfortunately, I'm the standard bearer. A breeze rolled in. She wrapped herself tighter in my jacket and stood beside me. We sat like that for half an hour, in silence, listening to the voices from the edge of the dark. Finally, I leaned and kissed her. She quickly kissed me back. That was more like an answer than a statement. For a moment, we were dumb to what was happening. We weren't drunk. I asked her if she had ever kissed an Asian before. She laughed and said she wasn't thinking about it that way, but no. You taste strange, but only because I don't know you. Hold on. She kissed me again, lingering this time. Definitely Korean, she said, nodding. Then she stopped. Hey, are you enjoying this? I smiled and said, couldn't she tell? She searched my eyes. No, she said, now aroused. I really can't. I did something then that I didn't know I could do. It was strangely automatic. Instantly, I was thinking of the lover she might want, the man whom she searched out but hadn't yet found in her life. I thought of the ways Nils was perhaps falling short. I put myself in her place and imagined her father and mother, boyfriends, recent loves. I made those phantom calculations, did all that blind math so that I might cast for her the perfect picture of a face. I embraced her firmly and kissed her. You can kiss me back, you know, I said. I'm leaving tomorrow, so don't worry. I won't hold you to it. I stayed another whole week. Later, and throughout our marriage, Lelia liked to speak of those first days. She would trace us back to that beginning time, like some evolutionist. Maybe she thought certain clues would arise from the primordial pool to make sense of our eventual difficulties. Were there traits or habits of personality that we had too readily dismissed, too easily obliged? But then marriage must be the willingness to walk the blind alleys. Maybe I know that. You don't tempt fate, you ignore it completely. During the 2 months she was gone in the Italian islands, I walked the streets of the city with my back blind. I was matching the steps of my soloist wife at the other end of the world. At times I found myself moving to her own ambling, driven gait, round on the heels, nearly race-walking, breasts forward in guidance, my life's ballast. I mimicked her high but never shrill voice. I felt the blush of an anger rise on my neck. I could even see myself maddeningly centered as usual, hunched at the far end of our empty and too large apartment, sipping easy liquor. Naturally, I came to see the list as indicative. Naturally, I came to see the list as indicative of her failures as well as mine. What we shared, it was a list of our sad children. My eventual folly, played out in a bar in East New York, was that I came to know the list intimately as my own, as if I alone had authored it. I treasured the cheapest sort of vanity. I flashed it with a grotesque pride, feigning shame. I showed it to some hard grunge types, to their even harder women, to red-faced professionals. I let them call me the Yellow Peril. They named a drink after this, some emetic concoction of Galliano and white wine with which we toasted each other all night. Drunk, overgenerous, I let them tack it to the wall with a dart. This, the herald of our marriage. The day after she left, I asked Jack Palansakos what he knew about the places my wife would be, whether they were beautiful, striking, possibly dangerous. You mean, will she take a lover there, he said, his thick mustache spiced with strong oils. He was our office expert in affairs Mediterranean. I must have nodded. I doubt she will, he answered himself, unless she favors Asiatic, hollow-cheeked boys, lean young swimmers. But then I look at you. Of course he knew this was what I wanted to hear. I pressed him on and learned only that the Emperor Diocletian had built a resplendent palace on the shores of the Adriatic for his retirement, of all things, as he might escape the snarls of his Rome. Jack was himself a cool-blooded demigod in a previous life. He had maybe 20 years in the firm. Any nobility resided in his powerful brow. His other features necessarily surrendered to it. He had massive, soft hands, which he pressed flatly against his temples when he spoke. It often looked as if he had witnessed something disastrous. My advice, he said, before you ask for it, is that you go to her. Take the next boat. Jack was much older than you thought. Make short passage, he urged me. Find her quickly. She wouldn't give me her address. She said she'd send it. Henry Park isn't one to follow his woman anyway, said Ichibata, who sat near him. Henry Park sends a tale. Pete Ichibata was gloomy, ironical, pale. I liked him immensely, his sullenness, his corpse-like color, except when he lodged in a good mood, when he became overbearing and megalomaniacal. He shelled peanuts obsessively. You crackled when you neared his desk. His early warning system. You crackled when he neared his desk, his early warning system. My mother, in her hurt, invaded Korea way. Whoa. My mother, in her hurt, invaded Korean way, would have counseled me to distrust him, this clever Japanese. Then, too, she would have advised me against my marriage to Lelia, the lengthy Anglican goddess who'd measure me ceaselessly while I slept, continually appraise our vast differences, count up the ways. Go on, Pete, Kalantzakos said over his shoulder. Do the drill for surveilling a woman. You stalk them, I know. You've got to be careful, Pete answered. Women, especially in urban areas, are naturally defensive. They're sensitive to predation, men bearing gifts. They believe at all times that somebody is spooking them, though this mindset is also useful to the spook. You present yourself as a shield. The key is to walk with them on their side as the protector. You follow by leading. Pete's now a Muslim, spoke up Dennis Hoagland, our director. This morning I caught him praying in the John, moaning to some higher power. I think he was pointed straight at your desk, Grace. Grace made a flourish with her hand, queen-like. She was working through a stack of papers and photographs. I knew she was hearing and remembering everything that was being said. Weeks later, she might comment on the conversation, whether she had participated or not. Like the rest of us, over the years, she had developed extremely keen powers of observation and recollection. I often wondered if she even liked this. I was puking, Dennis, Pete replied. I thought you were too. Pete was a drinker. Not too bad yet, but maybe on the start to something tragic. Dennis Hoagland, I didn't know about. His colon was probably spastic. He was dyspeptic, fitful, an alimentary type. He often reeked of Maalox. He looked fine to the eye, ruddy, pumping pink, but you sensed he was somehow on the brink of death. Pete turned to Grace. For the record, he said, I save my prayers for after work. That's when I'm feeling contrite. Why not work on our guilt and shame together? What do you say, sweetheart? Grace tucked the pencil behind her ear. She said deadpan, I don't know what you mean, Pete. I like the business. It's a good one. I make good money, meet nice people. You're murderous, Grace. Why, thank you. We casually spoke of ourselves as business people, domestic travelers. We went wherever there was a need. The urgency of that need, like much of everything else, was determined by some calculus of power and money. Political force, the fluid motion of capital, influence on your fellow man. These basics drove our livelihood. In a phrase, we were spies. But the sound of that is all wrong. We weren't the kind of figures you naturally thought of, or maybe even hoped existed. Hoagland, who had recruited me, told me once that our job was simply to even things out, clear the market, as it were, act as secret arbitrators. I pretended to believe him. We pledged allegiance to no government. We weren't ourselves political creatures. We weren't patriots, even less heroes. We systematically overassessed risks, made it a bad word. Guns spooked us. Jack kept a pistol in his desk, but it didn't work. We knew nothing of weaponry, torture, psychological warfare, extortion, electronics, supercomputers, explosives. Never anything like that. Our office motto? Cowardice is what you make of it. We chose instead to deal in people. Each of us engaged our own kind, more or less. Foreign workers, immigrants, first generationals, neo-Americans. I work with Koreans, Pete with Japanese. We split up the rest, the Chinese, Laotians, Singaporeans, Filipinos, the whole transplanted Pacific Rim. Grace handled Eastern Europe, Jack the Mediterranean and Middle East, the two Jimmies, Baptiste and Perez, Central America and Africa. There were a few others, freelancers who stepped in when we needed them. Dennis Hoagland had established the firm in the mid-70s when another influx of newcomers was arriving. He said he knew a growth industry when he saw one, and there was no other firms with any ethnic coverage to speak of. The same reason the CIA had such shoddy intelligence in non-white countries. Hoagland oversaw the operations from our modest offices in Westchester County. He was the cultural dispatcher. Our clients were multinational corporations, bureaus of foreign governments, individuals of resources and connection. We provided them with information about people working against their vested interest. We generated background studies, psychological assessments, daily chronologies, myriad facts and extrapolations. These and extensive reports. Typically, the subject was a well-to-do immigrant supporting some potential insurgency in his old land, or else funding a fledgling trade union or radical student organization. Sometimes he was simply an agitator, maybe a writer of conscience, an expatriate artist. We worked by contriving intricate and open-ended emotional conspiracies. We became acquaintances, casual friends, sometimes lovers. We were social drinkers. Embracers of children, doubles partners. We threw rice at weddings. We laid wreaths at funerals. We ate sweet pastries in the basement of churches. Then we wrote the tract of their lives, remote, unauthorized biographies. I, the most prodigal and mundane of historians. Okay, next chapter. The intrigue. Always the intrigue. That certain sequence of unrelated events. Then bang. Dennis Hoagland said that in our time, there was only two or three worth talking. There was only two or three worth talking about for complexities, fascination, depth of involvement. JFK, Watergate, the attempt on the Pope. Modern classics. He acknowledged outright that it was a personal matter, this choosing of one's mysteries. He said you could tell about a person not from what he believed, but by what worried him. Hoagland necessarily considered everyone a world political creature with a heightened persona, a neurotic cultural manner. Of course, there were whole legions of adherents to his view. There were still out there handfuls of committed Pearl Harbor theorists, devotees of the Hindenburg disaster, the UFO Pentagon conspiracists, Amelia Earhart gurus. Recently, I received in the mail a handwritten pamphlet outlining the spread of HIV by the FBI. They were releasing infected mosquitoes by the billions. This is the worry alive and well everywhere. It's people like Hoagland who call you up at a odd at that. Hey, Lob. Lob's coming in to set up. Ooh, he's bringing a, huh? Yeah, that's fine. This is a casual show. Okay. I'm practicing my reading aloud. Let's go back. Right. This is the worry alive and well everywhere. It's people like Hoagland who call you up at odd hours of the night to tell you something you absolutely need to know, practicing on you the subtlest form of sleep deprivation, half-conscious training. 2 a.m, 3, he would ring. I'd get angry with him, and he would apologize deeply, but 2 nights later, he started again. He did this after Lila's return from the islands. I was spending less time up at the office in Purchase doing whatever work I could from the apartment, mostly because I wanted to live there as much as I could, make it a home somehow, thinking this might draw Lelia back sooner than she was planning. But then Hoagland was complaining. Everyone else was out of the office, and he had no one to spook or harass. So what are we putting you on, Harry? Hoagland liked to call me Harry. It made him feel like an old-timer, venerable. John Kwong, I said, seeing the time on the clock, 4:15. Right, he answered. He knew everything, certainly, but he just wanted me to do the drill. He said, John Kwong, the rising star of the East, Prince of Northern Boulevard. What goes on? You want to look at it?
I got to set up.
Yeah. Here, you can unplug this and take that. What are you going to do? Are you going to make a new? What are you doing?
I don't want to interrupt.
Do you know how to get to the new screen? Yeah. Okay. Where am I? Here, come over here. Hold on. I got to help Lob. You want to get to the internet?
Yeah.
Yeah, they do three fingers. Okay, let me give you a clean page. Hold on. Okay. You just need the internet?
Yeah.
Okay. I gotta pee. It's a good thing this show is almost over. It's hard to read. Yeah, I have a lot of, the person who read Three Body Problem is real good at it. I'm not so good at it, but it's okay. Okay. What am I doing? Okay. Okay, what goes on? You tell me, I said. We'll be placing you soon, he replied, typically confident. I have a line on a position in his staff, some public relations work. How do you like that? Fine, I answered. Jack asked me yesterday, what name will I use? Whatever you like this time, Bruce Lee for all I care. Bigot. To hell with that. I know Enter the Dragon by the frame. I've had these dreams. I reach into people's hearts. I have emotional content. Ask me anything. I knew he could recite the whole movie. I've got to go, I told him. Fine, fine. When are you going to show up here? Not for a few days. I've got to work on some things. I heard, he said thickly. Where's Lelia? Grace said she finally came back. I paused. She's around. Good. I want my people happy. I want you happy, Harry. I need you that way for all our sake. It's imperative. You're right, boss. I want to be happy. Fantastic. Good dreams. And come in soon. I mean it. I hung up, but after 20 minutes of tossing, I got out of bed. I usually couldn't sleep after his calls. Not so much from anything he would say. It was mostly his tone that kept me awake, the lingering question of it, the brand of itch that was his voice. I could never simply ignore it, put it off, and I would rise and in half sleep drift about the darkness of the large apartment, inexplicably checking the corners and the closet for things out of the ordinary, an unmatched shoe, a coat fallen from a hanger, a tie I didn't recognize, those tiny marks of what can go on while you sleep. Of course, it was just my drowsy madness, though it dawned on me that I had become more like Hoagland than I would have liked to admit. My years with them and the rest of them, even good Jack, had somehow colored me funny, marked me. But I knew Hoagland, in truth, was taking it easy on me. His phone calls were just payback for the recent cushion he had given me. For the only time in the last few months, I had gone out on assignment, actually courted a live body. I had nearly blown cover. It was when Lelia was away. He was a Filipino psychoanalyst, a Marcos sympathizer. Emil Luzon, PhD. I was one of his patients. I was a successful mortgage broker, married, seemingly poised at the sweet prime of my life. But I was troubled. I was drinking three or four cocktails a day. I wasn't making love to my wife. I couldn't sleep at night, and I had sudden fits of anger and sadness. I was eating too much. I told him that a Dr. Hoagland had referred me. Depression, first episode. You'll be fine, Luzon said to me gently. You'll be yourself again, I promise. In the initial period, everything was going well. Our sessions were becoming increasingly intense. I was elaborating upon my quote-unquote legend consistently, and Luzon accepted my pathologies. The legend was something each of us wrote out in preparation for any assignment. It was an extraordinary, extensive story of who we were, an autobiography as such, often evolving to develop even the minutiae of life experience, countless facts and figures, though it also required a truthful ontological bearing, a certain presence of character. In his earnestness, Dr. Luzon kept delving further into my psyche, plumbing the depths. I was developing into a model case. Of course, I was switching between him and me, getting piecemeals of the doctor with projections in an almost classical mode. But the first time, I found myself at moments running short of my story, my chosen narrative. Normally, I would have ceased matters temporarily, retreated to Westchester to reiterate and revise. But inexplicably, I began stringing the legend back upon myself. I was no longer extrapolating. I was looping it through the core, freely talking about my life, suddenly breaching the confidence of my father and my mother and my wife. I even spoke to him about a lost dead son. I was becoming becoming dangerously frank, inconsistently schizophrenic. I ceased listening to him altogether. Like a good doctor, he let me go on, and in moments I felt he was the only one in the world who might comfort me. I genuinely began to like him. I looked forward to our 50-minute sessions on Thursday mornings, enough so that we began meeting on Mondays as well. Hoagland assumed I was stepping up the operation. When I was in the chair across the desk from Luzon, I completely lost myself. I was becoming a dependent, a friend. Hoagland, not hearing from me, sent in Jack Kalatzakos to retrieve my remains, my exposed bones. I knew Hoagland was still wondering if he had done so in time. He wanted me back with the program. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, let me get my... Okay, anyways, that's the end of that. Right up to page 23 of Native Speaker. That's good. I think I have to read to, like, 139. Oh, my God, I have 100 more pages, but more to go. I can do it. Okay, so, Lob, just FYI, the mic is sensitive. There's no compressor.
Okay.
Okay, so and then the headphones still have that weird echo.
Okay.
Okay, bye, everyone.